wires and electricity and free radiation, and drank until I was drunk enough to go to sleep. What I called the den was really the living room. I made it my workplace because it had the nicest light in the whole apartment. A big westward-facing window that looked all the way to the horizon. That's something close to the miracle of the loaves and fishes in a fifth-floor Manhattan apartment. But the line of sight was there. I didn't question it. I just enjoyed it. That room was filled with a dear, lovely light even on rainy days. But the quality of the light that evening was eerie. The sunset had filled the room with a red glow, furnace light. Empty, the room seemed too big. My heels made flat echoes on the hardwood floor. The typewriter sat in the middle of the floor, and I was just going around it when I saw there was a ragged scrap of paper stuck under the roller. That gave me a start because I knew there had been no paper in the machine when I went out for the last time to get the fresh bottle. I looked around, wondering if there was someone, some intruder, in the place with me. Except it wasn't really intruders or burglars or junkies I was thinking of. It was ghosts. I saw a ragged blank place on the wall to the left of the bedroom door. I at least understood where the paper and the typewriter had come from. Someone had simply torn off a ragged piece of the old wallpaper. I was still looking at this when I heard a single small clear noise, clack, from behind me. I jumped and whirled around with my heart knocking in my throat. I was terrified, but I knew what that sound was just the same. There was no question at all. You work with words all your life, and you know the sound of a typewriter platen hitting paper, even in a deserted room at dusk where there is no one to strike the key. They looked at him in the dark, their faces blurred white circles, saying nothing, slightly huddled together now. The writer's wife was holding one of the writer's hands tightly in both of her own. I felt outside myself, unreal. Perhaps this is always the way one feels when one arrives at the point of the inexplicable. I walked slowly over to the typewriter. My heart was pounding madly up there in my throat, but I felt mentally calm, icy even. Clack. Another platen popped up. I saw it this time. The key was in the third row from the top, on the left. I got down on my knees very slowly. And then all the muscles in my legs seemed to go slack, and I half swooned the rest of the way down, until I was sitting there in front of the typewriter with my dirty London fog top coat spread around me like the skirt of a girl who has made her very deepest curtsy. The typewriter clacked twice more, fast, paused, then clacked again. Each clack made the same kind of flat echo my footfalls had made on the floor. The wallpaper had been rolled into the machine so that the side with the dried glue on it was facing out. The letters were ripply and bumpy, but I could read them. R-A-C-K-N, it said. Then it clacked again, and the word was Rackney. Then he cleared his throat and grinned a little. Even all these years later, this is hard to tell. To just say right out. Okay. The simple fact, with no icing on it, is this. I saw a hand come out of the typewriter. An incredibly tiny hand. It came out from between the keys B and N in the bottom row, curled itself into a fist, and hammered down on the space bar. The machine jumped a space, very fast, like a hiccup, and the hand drew back down inside. The agent's wife giggled shrilly. "Can it, Marcia?" the agent said softly, and she did. The clacks began to come a little faster, the editor went on, and after a while I fancied I could hear the creature that was shoving the key arms up, gasping, the way anyone will gasp when he is working hard, coming closer and closer to his physical limit. After a while the machine was hardly printing at all, and most of the keys were filled with that old gluey stuff, but I could read the impressions. It got out, Rackney is D, and then the Y key stuck to the glue. I looked at it for a moment, and then I reached out one finger and freed it. I don't know if it, Belus could have freed it himself. I think not, but I didn't want to see it, him, try. Just the fist was enough to have me tottering on the brink. If I saw the elf entire, so to speak, I think I really would have gone crazy. And there was no question of getting up to run. All the strength had gone out of my legs. Clack, 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 those tiny grunts and sobs of effort. And after every word, that pallid, ink and dirt-streaked fist would come out between the B and the N and hammer down on the space bar. I don't know exactly how long it went on. 7 minutes, maybe. Maybe 10. Or maybe forever. Finally, the clack stopped, and I realized I couldn't hear him breathing anymore. Maybe he fainted. Maybe he just gave up and went away. Or maybe he died. Had a heart attack or something. All I really know for sure is that the message was not finished. It read, completely in lowercase, "Rackney is dying. It's the little boy, Jimmy Thorpe. Doesn't know. Tell Thorpe Rackney is dying. The little boy, Jimmy, is killing Rackney. Bell." And that was all. I found the strength to get to my feet then, and I left the room. I walked in great big tippy-toe steps, as if I thought it had gone to sleep, and if I made any of those flat, echoey noises on the bare wood, it would wake up, and the typing would start again. And I thought if it did, the first clack would start me screaming. And then I would just go on until my heart or my head burst. My Chevy was in the parking lot down the street, all gassed and loaded and ready to go. I got in behind the wheel and remembered the bottle in my topcoat pocket. My hands were shaking so badly that I dropped it, but it landed on the seat and didn't break. I remembered the blackouts, and my friends, right then a blackout was exactly what I wanted and exactly what I got. I remember taking the first drink from the neck of the bottle and the second. I remember turning the key over to accessory and getting Frank Sinatra on the radio singing that old Black Magic, which seemed fitting enough, under the circumstances, so to speak. I remember singing along and having a few more drinks. I was in the back row of the lot and I could see the traffic light on the corner going through its paces. I kept thinking of those flat clacking sounds in the empty room and the fading red light in the den. I kept thinking of those puffing sounds, as if some bodybuilding elf had hung fishing sinkers on the ends of a Q-tip and was doing bench presses inside my old typewriter. I kept seeing the pebbly surface on the backside of that torn scrap of wallpaper. My mind kept wanting to examine what must have gone on before I came back to the apartment. Kept wanting to see it. Him. Belus. Jumping up, grabbing the loose edge of the wallpaper by the door to the bedroom, because it was the only thing left in the room approximating paper, hanging on, finally tearing it loose and carrying it back to the typewriter on his head, like the leaf of a nipa palm. I kept trying to imagine how it could ever have run it into the typewriter. And none of that was blacking out, so I kept drinking, and Frank Sinatra stopped. And there was an ad for Crazy Eddies, and then Sarah Vaughan came on singing, "I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter," and that was something else I could relate to, since I'd done just that recently, or at least I thought I had, until tonight, when something happened to give me cause to rethink my position on that matter, so to speak, and I sang along with good old Sarah Soul, and right about then I must have achieved escape velocity, because in the middle of the second chorus, with no lag at all, I was puking my guts out while somebody first thumped my back with his palms and then lifted my elbows behind me and put them down and then thumped my back with his palms again. That was the trucker. Every time he thumped, I'd feel a great clot of liquid rise up in my throat and get ready to go back down, except then he'd lift my elbows, and every time he lifted my elbows, I'd puke again, and most of it wasn't even black velvet but river water. When I was able to lift my head enough to look around, it was 6 o'clock in the evening, 3 days later, and I was lying on the bank of the Jackson River in western Pennsylvania, about 60 miles north of Pittsburgh. My Chevy was sticking out of the river, rear end up. I could still read the McCarthy sticker on the bumper. Is there another fresca, love? My throat's dry as hell. The writer's wife fetched him one silently, and when she handed it to him, she impulsively bent and kissed his wrinkled alligator hide cheek. He smiled, and his eyes sparkled in the dim light. She was, however, a good and kindly woman, and the sparkle did not in any way fool her. It was never merriness which made eyes sparkle that way. Thank you, Meg. He drank deeply, coughed, waved away the offer of a cigarette. I've had enough of those for the evening. I'm going to quit them entirely, in my next incarnation, so to speak. The rest of my tale really needs no telling. It would have against it the only sin that any tale can ever really be guilty of. It's predictable. They fished something like 40 bottles of black velvet out of my car, a good many of them empty. I was babbling about elves and electricity and Fornets and plutonium miners and Fornus, and I seemed utterly insane to them, and that, of course, is exactly what I was. Now, here's what happened in Omaha while I was driving around, according to the gas credit slips in the Chevy's glove compartment, 5 northeastern states. All of this, you understand, was information I obtained from Jane Thorpe over a long and painful period of correspondence, which culminated in a face-to-face meeting in New Haven, where she now lives, shortly after I was dismissed from the sanitarium as a reward for finally recanting. At the end of that meeting, we wept in each other's arms, and that was when I began to believe that there could be a real life for me, perhaps even happiness, again. That day, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a knock at the door of the Thorpe home. It was a telegraph boy. The telegram was from me, the last item of our unfortunate correspondence. It read, "Reg, have reliable information that Rackney is dying. It's the little boy, according to Bellis. Bellis says the boy's name is Jimmy. Fornet some Fornus, Henry." In case that marvelous Howard Baker question of what did he know and when did he know it has gone through your mind, I can tell you that I knew Jane had hired a cleaning woman. I didn't know, except through Bellis, that she had a little devil son named Jimmy. I suppose you'll have to take my word for that, although in all fairness, I have to add that the shrinks who worked on my case over the next 2.5 years never did. When the telegram came, Jane was at the grocery store. She found it after Reg was dead, in one of his back pockets. The time of transmission and delivery were both noted on it, along with the added line, "No telephone, deliver original." Jane said that although the telegram was only a day old, it had been so much handled that it looked as if he'd had it for a month. In a way, that telegram, those 26 words, was the real flexible bullet, and I fired it directly into Reg Thorpe's brain, all the way from Paterson, New Jersey, and I was so fucking drunk I don't even remember doing it. During the last 2 weeks of his life, Reg had fallen into a pattern that seemed normality itself. He got up at 6, made breakfast for himself and his wife, then wrote for an hour. Around 8 o'clock, he would lock his study and take the dog for a long, leisurely walk around the neighborhood. He was very forthcoming on these walks, stopping to chat with anyone who wanted to chat with him, tying the pooch outside a nearby cafe to have a mid-morning cup of coffee, then rambling on again. He rarely got back to the house before noon. On many days, it was 12:30 or 1 o'clock. Part of this was an effort to escape the garrulous Gertrude Rulin, Jane believed, because his pattern hadn't really begun to solidify until a couple of days after she started working for them. He would eat a light lunch, lie down for an hour or so, then get up and write for 2 or 3 hours. In the evenings, he would sometimes go next door to visit with the young people, either with Jane or alone. Sometimes he and Jane took in a movie, or just sat in the living room and read. They turned in early, Reg usually a while before Jane. She wrote there was very little sex, and what there was of it was unsuccessful for both of them. But sex isn't as important for most women, she said, and Reg was working full out again, and that was a reasonable substitute for him. I would say that under the circumstances, those last 2 weeks were the happiest in the last 5 years. I damn near cried when I read that. I didn't know anything about Jimmy, but Reg did. Reg knew everything except for the most important fact, that Jimmy had started coming to work with his mother. How furious he must have been when he got my telegram and began to realize here they were, after all. And apparently his own wife was one of them, because she was in the house when Gertrude and Jimmy were there, and she had never said a thing to Reg about Jimmy. What was it he had written to me in that earlier letter? Sometimes I wonder about my wife. When she arrived home on the day that the telegram came, she found Reg gone. There was a note on the kitchen table which said, "Love, I've gone down to the bookstore, back by supper time." This seemed perfectly fine to Jane, but if Jane had known about my telegram, the very normality of that note would have scared the hell out of her, I think. She would have understood that Reg believed she had changed sides. Reg didn't go near any bookstore. He went to Little John's Gun Emporium downtown. He bought a .45 automatic and 2,000 rounds of ammunition. He would have bought an AK-70 if Little John's had been allowed to sell them. He meant to protect his Fornet, you see, from Jimmy, from Gertrude, from Jane, from them. Everything went according to established routine the next morning. She remembered thinking he was wearing an awfully heavy sweater for such a warm fall day, but that was all. The sweater, of course, was because of the gun. He went out to walk the dog with the .45 stuffed into the waistband of his chinos. Except the restaurant where he usually got his morning coffee was as far as he went, and he went directly there, with no lingering or conversation along the way. He took the pup around to the loading area, tied its leash to a railing, and then went back toward his house by way of backyards. He knew the schedule of the young people next door very well, knew they would all be out. He knew where they kept their spare key. He let himself in, went upstairs, and watched his own house. At 8:40, he saw Gertrude Rulin arrive. And Gertrude wasn't alone. There was indeed a small boy with her. Jimmy Rulin's boisterous first-grade behavior convinced the teacher and the school guidance counselor almost at once that everyone, except maybe Jimmy's mother, who could have used a rest from Jimmy, would be better off if he waited another year. Jimmy was stuck with repeating kindergarten, and he had afternoon sessions for the first half of the year. The two daycare centers in her area were full, and she couldn't change to afternoons for the Thorpes because she had another cleaning job on the other side of town from 2 to 4. The upshot of everything was Jane's reluctant agreement that Gertrude could bring Jimmy with her until she was able to make other arrangements, or until Reg found out, as he was sure to do. She thought Reg might not mind. He had been so sweetly reasonable about everything lately. On the other hand, he might have a fit. If that happened, other arrangements would have to be made. Gertrude said she understood, and for heaven's sake, Jane added, the boy was not to touch any of Reg's things. Gertrude said for sure not. The mister's study door was locked and would stay locked. Thorpe must have crossed between the 2 yards like a sniper crossing no man's land. He saw Gertrude and Jane washing bed linens in the kitchen. He didn't see the boy. He moved along the side of the house, no one in the dining room, no one in the bedroom, and then in the study, where Reg had morbidly expected to see him, there Jimmy was. The kid's face was hot with excitement, and Reg surely must have believed that here was a bona fide agent of they at last. The boy was holding some sort of death ray in his hand. It was pointed at the desk, and from inside his typewriter, Reg could hear Rackney screaming. You may think I'm attributing subjective data to a man who's now dead, or, to be more blunt, making stuff up, but I'm not. In the kitchen, both Jane and Gertrude heard the distinctive warbling sound of Jimmy's plastic space blaster. He'd been shooting it around the house ever since he started coming with his mother, and Jane hoped daily that its batteries would go dead. There was no mistaking the sound, no mistaking the place it was coming from either. Reg's study. The kid really was Dennis the Menace material, you know? If there was a room in the house where he wasn't supposed to go, That was the one place he had to go or die of curiosity. It didn't take him long to discover that Jane kept a key to Reg's study on the dining room mantle either. Had he been in there before? I think so. Jane said she remembered giving the boy an orange 3 or 4 days before, and later, when she was clearing out the house, she found orange peels under the little studio sofa in that room. Reg didn't eat oranges, claimed he was allergic to them. Jane dropped the sheet she was washing back into the sink and rushed into the bedroom. She heard the loud wah, wah, wah of the space blaster, and she heard Jimmy yelling,
"I'll get ya! You can't run! I can see you through the glass!"
And, she said that she heard something screaming. A high, despairing sound, she said, so full of pain it was almost insupportable. "When I heard that," she said, "I knew that I would have to leave Reg no matter what happened. Because all the old wives' tales were true, madness was catching. Because it was Rackney I was hearing. Somehow that rotten little kid was shooting Rackney, killing it with a $2 space gun from Kresge's. The study door was standing open, the key in it. Later on that day, I saw one of the dining room chairs standing by the mantel with Jimmy's sneaker prints all over the seat. He was bent over Reg's typewriter table. He, Reg, had an old office model with glass inserts on the sides. Jimmy had the muzzle of his blaster pressed against one of those and was shooting it into the typewriter. Wah, 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 and purple pulses of light shooting out of the typewriter, and suddenly I could understand everything Reg had ever said about electricity. Because although that thing ran on nothing more than harmless old C or D cells, it really did feel as if there were waves of poison coming out of that gun and rolling through my head and frying my brains.
I see you in there,"
Jimmy was screaming, and his face was filled with a small boy's glee. It was both beautiful and somehow gruesome.
"You can't run away from Captain Future. You're dead, alien."
And that screaming, getting weaker, smaller. "Jimmy, you stop it," I yelled. He jumped. I'd startled him. He turned around, looked at me, stuck out his tongue, and then pushed the blaster against the glass panel and started shooting again. Wah, 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 in that rotten purple light. Gertrude was coming down the hall, yelling for him to stop, to get out of there, that he was going to get the whipping of his life. And then the front door burst open and Reg came up the hall, bellowing. I got one good look at him and understood that he was insane. The gun was in his hand.
"Don't you shoot my baby!"
Gertrude screamed when she saw him and reached out to grapple with him. Reg simply clubbed her aside. Jimmy didn't even seem to realize any of this was going on. He just went on shooting the space blaster into the typewriter. I could see that purple light pulsing in the blackness between the keys, and it looked like one of those electrical arcs they tell you not to look out without a pair of special goggles, because otherwise it might boil your retinas and make you blind. Reg came in, shoving past me, knocking me over.
"Rackney!" he screamed. "You're killing Rackney!"
And even as Reg was rushing across the room, apparently planning to kill that child, Jane told me, I had time to wonder just how many times he had been in that room, shooting that gun into the typewriter when his mother and I were maybe upstairs changing beds or in the backyard hanging clothes where we couldn't hear the wah, 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 where we couldn't hear that thing, the Fornit, inside, screaming. Jimmy didn't stop even when Reg came bursting in, just kept shooting into the typewriter as if he knew it was his last chance. And since then, I have wondered if perhaps Reg wasn't right about they, too. Only maybe they just sort of float around. And every now and then they dive into a person's head like someone doing a double gainer into a swimming pool. And they get that somebody to do the dirty work and then check out again. And the guy they were in says, "Huh? Me? Did what?" And in the second before Reg got there, the screaming from inside the typewriter turned into a brief, drilling shriek, and I saw blood splatter all over the inside of that glass insert, as if whatever was in there had finally just exploded, the way they say a live animal will explode if you put it in a microwave oven. I know how crazy it sounds, but I saw that blood. It hit the glass in a blot and then started to run.
"Got it,"
Jimmy said, highly satisfied. "Got," then Reg threw him all the way across the room. He hit the wall. The gun was jarred out of his hand, hit the floor, and broke. It was nothing but plastic and Ever-Ready batteries, of course. Reg looked into the typewriter, and he screamed. Not a scream of pain or fury, although there was fury in it. Mostly it was a scream of grief. He turned toward the boy then. Jimmy had fallen to the floor, and whatever he had been, if he ever was anything more than just a mischievous little boy, now he was just a 6-year-old in terror. Reg pointed the gun at him, and that's all I remember. The editor finished his soda and put the can carefully aside. "Gertrude Rulin and Jimmy Rulin remember enough to make up for the lack," he said. Jane called out, "Reg, no!" And when he looked around at her, she got to her feet and grappled with him. He shot her, shattering her left elbow, but she didn't let go. As she continued to grapple with him, Gertrude called to her son, and Jimmy ran to her. Reg pushed Jane away and shot her again. This bullet tore along the left side of her skull, even an eighth of an inch to the right, and he would have killed her. There is little doubt of that, and none at all that if not for Jane Thorpe's intervention, he would have surely killed Jimmy Rulin and quite possibly the boy's mother as well. He did shoot the boy, as Jimmy ran into his mother's arms just outside the door. The bullet entered Jimmy's left buttock on a downward course. It exited from his upper left thigh, missing the bone, and passed through Gertrude Rulin's shin. There was a lot of blood, but no major damage done to either. Gertrude slammed the study door and carried her screaming, bleeding son down the hallway and out the front door. The editor paused again, thoughtfully. Jane was either unconscious by that time or she has deliberately chosen to forget what happened next. Reg sat down in his office chair and put the muzzle of the .45 against the center of his forehead. He pulled the trigger. The bullet did not pass through his brain and leave him a living vegetable, nor did it travel in a semicircle around his skull and exit harmlessly on the far side. The fantasy was flexible, but the final bullet was as hard as it could be. He fell forward across the typewriter, dead. When the police broke in, they found him that way. Jane was sitting in a far corner, semi-conscious. The typewriter was covered with blood, presumably filled with blood as well. Head wounds are very, very messy. All of the blood was type O, Reg Thorpe's type. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my story. I can tell no more. Indeed, the editor's voice had been reduced to a little more than a husky whisper. There was none of the usual post-party chatter, or even the awkwardly bright conversation people sometimes use to cover a cocktail party indiscretion of some moment, or to at least disguise the fact that things had at some point become much more serious than a dinner party situation usually warranted. But as the writer saw the editor to his car, he was unable to forbear one final question. "The story," he said. "What happened to the story?" "You mean Reg's..."
"The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet. That's right. The story that caused it all. That was the real flexible bullet, for you, if not for him. What in the hell happened to this story that was so goddamn great?"
The editor opened the door of his car. It was a small blue Chevette with a sticker on the back bumper which read, "Friends don't let friends drive drunk." "No, it was never published. If Reg had a carbon copy, he destroyed it following my receipt and acceptance of the tale. Considering his paranoid feelings about they, that would have been very much in character. I had his original plus 3 photocopies with me when I went into the Jackson River, all 4 in a cardboard carton. If I'd put that carton in the trunk, I would have the story now, because the rear end of my car never went under. Even if it had, the pages could have been dried out. But I wanted it close to me, so I put it in the front on the driver's side. The windows were open when I went into the water. The pages, I assume they just floated away and were carried out to sea. I'd rather believe that than believe they rotted along with the rest of the trash at the bottom of that river, or were eaten by catfish, or something even less aesthetically pleasing. To believe they were carried out to sea is more romantic and slightly more unlikely, but in manners of what I choose to believe, I find I can still be flexible, so to speak. The editor got into his small car and drove away. The writer stood and watched until the taillights had winked out and then turned around. Meg was there, standing at the head of their walk in the darkness, smiling a little tentatively at him. Her arms were crossed tightly across her bosom, although the night was warm. "We're the last two," she said. "Want to go in?" "Sure." Halfway up the walk, she stopped and said, "There are no Fornets in your typewriter, are there, Paul?" And the writer, who had sometimes, often, wondered exactly where the words did come from, said bravely, "Absolutely not." They went inside arm in arm and closed the door against the night.
The Reach. Read by Lois Smith.
The reach was wider in those days, Stella Flanders told her great-grandchildren in the last summer of her life, the summer before she began to see ghosts. The children looked at her with wide, silent eyes, and her son Alden turned from his seat on the porch where he was whittling. It was Sunday, and Alden wouldn't take his boat out on Sundays, no matter how high the price of lobster was. "What do you mean, Graham?" Tommy asked, but the old woman did not answer. She only sat in her rocker by the cold stove, her slippers bumping placidly on the floor. Tommy asked his mother, "What does she mean?" Lois only shook her head, smiled, and sent them out with pots to pick berries. Stella thought, "She's forgot, or did she ever know?" The reach had been wider in those days. If anyone knew it was so, that person was Stella Flanders. She had been born in 1884, she was the oldest resident of Goat Island, and she had never once in her life been to the mainland. "Do you love?" This question had begun to plague her, and she did not even know what it meant. Fall set in, a cold fall, without the necessary rain to bring a really fine color to the trees, either on Goat or on Raccoon Head across the reach. The wind blew long, cold notes that fall, and Stella felt each note resonate in her heart. On November 19, when the first flurries came swirling down out of a sky the color of white chrome, Stella celebrated her birthday. Most of the village turned out. Hattie Stoddard came, whose mother had died of pleurisy in 1954, and whose father had been lost with the dancer in 1941. Richard and Mary Dodge came, Richard moving slowly up the path on his cane, his arthritis riding him like an invisible passenger. Sarah Havelock came, of course. Sarah's mother, Annabelle, had been Stella's best friend. They had gone to the island school together, grades 1 to 8, and Annabelle had married Tommy Frayne, who had pulled her hair in the 5th grade and made her cry, just as Stella had married Bill Flanders, who had once knocked all of her school books out of her arms and into the mud, but she had managed not to cry. Now both Annabelle and Tommy were gone, and Sarah was the only one of their 7 children still on the island. Her husband, George Havelock, who had been known to everyone as Big George, had died a nasty death over on the mainland in 1967, the year there was no fishing. An axe had slipped in Big George's hand. There had been blood, too much of it, and an island funeral 3 days later. And when Sarah came in to Stella's party and cried, "Happy birthday, Graham!" Stella hugged her tight and closed her eyes. "Do you love?" but she did not cry. There was a tremendous birthday cake. Hattie had made it with her best friend, Vera Spruce. The assembled company bellowed out, "Happy birthday to you," in a combined voice that was loud enough to drown out the wind, for a little while, anyway. Even Alden sang, who in the normal course of events would sing only "Onward Christian Soldiers" and the doxology in church, and would mouth the words of all the rest with his head hunched and his big old jug ears just as red as tomatoes. There were 95 candles on Stella's cake, and even over the singing she heard the wind, although her hearing was not what it once had been. She thought the wind was calling her name. "I was not the only one," she would have told Lois's children if she could. "In my day there were many that lived and died on the island." There was no mail boat in those days. Bull Symes used to bring the mail when there was mail. There was no ferry, either. If you had business on the head, your man took you in the lobster boat. So far as I know, there wasn't a flushing toilet on the island until 1946. 'Twas Bull's boy Harold that put in the first one the year after the heart attack carried Bull off while he was out dragging traps. I remember seeing them bring Bull home. I remember that they brought him up wrapped in a tarpaulin, and how one of his green boots poked out. I remember. And they would say, "What, Graham, what do you remember?" How would she answer them? Was there more? On the first day of winter, a month or so after the birthday party, Stella opened the back door to get stove wood and discovered a dead sparrow on the back stoop. She bent down carefully, picked it up by one foot, and looked at it. "Frozen," she announced, and something inside her spoke another word. It had been 40 years since she had seen a frozen bird. 1938, the year the Reach had frozen. Shuddering, pulling her coat closer, she threw the dead sparrow in the old rusty incinerator as she went by it. The day was cold. The sky was a clear, deep blue. On the night of her birthday, 4 inches of snow had fallen, had melted, and no more had come since then. "Got to come soon," Larry McKean down at the Goat Island store said sagely, as if daring winter to stay away. Stella got to the woodpile, picked herself an armload, and carried it back to the house. Her shadow, crisp and clean, followed her. As she reached the back door, where the sparrow had fallen, Bill spoke to her. But the cancer had taken Bill 12 years before. "Stella," Bill said, and she saw his shadow fall beside her. Longer, but just as clear-cut, the shadow Bill of his shadow cap twisted jauntily off to one side, just as he had always worn it. Stella felt a scream lodged in her throat. It was too large to touch her lips. "Stella," he said again, "when you come and cross to the mainland, we'll get Norm Jolly's old fort and go down to Beans and Freeport just for a lark. What do you say?" She wheeled, almost dropping her wood, and there was no one there. Just the dooryard sloping down to the hill, then the wild white grass, and beyond all, at the edge of everything, clear-cut and somehow magnified, the Reach, and the mainland beyond it. "Graham, what's the Reach?" Lona might have asked, although she never had. And she would have given them the answer any fisherman knew by rote. "A reach is a body of water between two bodies of land, a body of water which is open at either end." The old lobsterman's joke went like this. "Know how to read your compass when the fog comes, boys. Between Jonesport and London, there's a mighty long reach." "Reach is the water between the island and the mainland," she might have amplified, giving them molasses cookies and hot tea laced with sugar. "I know that much. I know it as well as my husband's name, and how he used to wear his hat." "Graham," Lona would say, "how come you never been across the Reach?" "Honey," she would say, "I never saw any reason to go." In January, 2 months after the birthday party, the Reach froze for the first time since 1938. The radio warned islanders and mainlanders alike not to trust the ice. But Stewie McClelland and Russell Boy took Stewie's Bombardier Ski-Doo out anyway after a long afternoon spent drinking apples apple wine, and sure enough, the Ski-Doo went into the reach. Stewie managed to crawl out, although he lost 1 foot to frostbite. The reach took Russell Boy and carried him away. That January 25, there was a memorial service for Russell. Stella went on her son Alden's arm, and he mouthed the words to the hymns and boomed out the doxology in his great tuneless voice before the benediction. Stella sat afterward with Sarah Havelock and Hattie Stoddard and Vera Spruce in the glow of the wood fire in the town hall basement. A going-away party for Russell was being held, complete with Za Rex punch and nice little cream cheese sandwiches cut into triangles. The men, of course, kept wandering out back for a nip of something a bit stronger than Za Rex. Russell Boy's new widow sat red-eyed and stunned beside Ewell McCracken, the minister. She was 7 months big with child. It would be her fifth. And Stella, half-dozing in the heat of the wood stove, thought, "She'll be crossing the reach soon enough, I guess. She'll move to Freeport or Lewiston and go for a waitress, I guess." She looked around at Vera and Hattie to see what the discussion was. "No, I didn't hear," Hattie said. "What did Freddie say?" They were talking about Freddie Dinsmore, the oldest man on the island, 2 years younger than me, though, Stella thought with some satisfaction, who had sold out his store to Larry McKean in 1960 and now lived on his retirement. "Said he'd never seen such a winter," Vera said, taking out her knitting. "He says it is going to make people sick." Sarah Havelock looked at Stella and asked if Stella had ever seen such a winter. There had been no snow since that first little bit. The ground lay crisp and bare and brown. The day before, Stella had walked 30 paces into the back field, holding her right hand level at the height of her thigh, and the grass there had snapped in a neat row with a sound like breaking glass. "Nope," Stella said. "The reach froze in 38. But there was snow that year. Do you remember Bull Symes, Hattie?" Hattie laughed. "I think I still have the black and blue he gave me on my sit-upon at the New Year's party in 53. He pinched me that hard. What about him?" "Bull and my own man walked across to the mainland that year," Stella said. That February of 1938, strapped on snowshoes, walked across to Dorrit's Tavern on the Head, had the meats a shot of whiskey and walked back. "They asked me to come along. They were like two little boys off to the sliding with a toboggan between them." They were looking at her, touched by the wonder of it. Even Vera was looking at her wide-eyed, and Vera had surely heard the tale before. If you believed the stories, Bull and Vera had once played some house together, although it was hard looking at Vera now to believe she had ever been so young. "And you didn't go?" Sarah asked, perhaps seeing the reach of the reach in her mind's eye, so white it was almost blue in the heatless winter sunshine, the sparkle of the snow crystals, the mainland drawing closer, walking across, yes, walking across the ocean, just like Jesus out of the boat, leaving the island for the one and only time in your life on foot? "No," Stella said. Suddenly she wished she had brought her own knitting. "I didn't go with them." "Why not?" Hattie asked, almost indignantly. "It was wash day," Stella almost snapped. And then Missy Bowie, Russell's widow, broke into loud, braying sobs. Stella looked over, and there sat Bill Flanders in his red and black check jacket, hat cocked to one side, smoking a Herbert Tarryton with another tucked behind his ear for later. She felt her heart leap into her chest and choke between beats. She made a noise, but just then a knot popped like a rifle shot in the stove, and neither of the other ladies heard. "Poor thing," Sarah nearly cooed. "Well, shut of that good-for-nothing," Hattie grunted. She searched for the grim depth of the truth concerning the departed Russell Boy, and found it. Little more than a tramp for pay, that man. She's well out of that two-hoss race. Stella, barely heard these things. There sat Bill, close enough to the Reverend McCracken to have tweaked his nose if he so had a mind. He looked no more than 40, his eyes barely marked by the crow's feet that had later sunk so deep, wearing his flannel pants and his gum-rubber boots with the gray wool socks folded down neatly over the tops. "We're waiting on you, Stell," he said. "You come on across and see the mainland. You won't need no snowshoes this year." There he sat in the town hall basement, big as Billy be damned, and then another knot exploded in the stove, and he was gone. And the Reverend McCracken went on comforting Missy Boy as if nothing had happened. That night Vera called up Annie Phillips on the phone, and in the course of the conversation mentioned to Annie that Stella Flanders didn't look well, not at all well. "Alden would have a scratch of a job getting her off island if she took sick," Annie said. Annie liked Alden, because her own son Toby had told her Alden would take nothing stronger than beer. Annie was strictly temperance herself. "Wouldn't get her off tall unless she was in a comer," Vera said, pronouncing the word in the Down East fashion, "comer." When Stella says frog, Alden jumps. Alden ain't but half bright, you know. Stella pretty much runs him. "Oh, Aya?" Annie said. Just then there was a metallic crackling sound on the line. Vera could hear Annie Phillips for a moment longer. Not the words, just the sound of her voice going on behind the crackling, and then there was nothing. The wind had gusted up high and the phone lines had gone down, maybe into Godland's Pond, or maybe down by Barrow's Cove, where they went into the reach sheathed in rubber. It was possible that they had gone down on the other side, on the head. And some might even have said, only half-joking, that Russell Bowie had reached up a cold hand to snap the cable just for the hell of it. Not 700 feet away, Stella Flanders lay under her puzzle quilt and listened to the dubious music of Alden's snores in the other room. She listened to Alden so she wouldn't have to listen to the wind. But she heard the wind anyway, oh yes, coming across the frozen expanse of the reach, a mile and a half of water that was now overplated with ice. Ice with lobsters down below, and groupers, and perhaps the twisting, dancing body of Russell Bowie, who used to come each April with his old Rogers rototiller and turn her garden. "Who'll turn the earth this April?" she wondered, as she lay cold and curled under her puzzle quilt. And as a dream in a dream, her voice answered her voice, "Do you love?" The wind gusted, rattling the storm window. It seemed that the storm window was talking to her, but she turned her face away from its words and did not cry. "But Graham?" Lona would press. She never gave up, not that one. She was like her mom and her grandmother before her. "You still haven't told why you never went across." "Why, child, I have always had everything I wanted right here on Goat." "But it's so small. We live in Portland. There's buses, Graham." "I see enough of what goes on in cities on the TV. I guess I'll stay where I am." Hal was younger, but somehow more intuitive. He would not press her, as his sister might. But his question would go closer to the heart of things. "You never wanted to go across, Graham? Never?" And she would lean toward him and take his small hands and tell him how her mother and father had come to the island shortly after they were married, and how Bull Symes's grandfather had taken Stella's father as apprentice on his boat. She would tell him how her mother had conceived 4 times, but one of her babies had miscarried and another had died a week after birth. She would have left the island if they could have saved it at the mainland hospital, but of course it was over before that was even thought of. She would tell them that Bill had delivered Jane, their grandmother, but not that when it was over he had gone into the bathroom and first puked and then wept like a hysterical woman who had her monthlies particularly bad. Jane, of course, had left the island at 14 to go to high school. Girls didn't get married at 14 anymore, and when Stella saw her go off in the boat with Bradley Maxwell, whose job it had been to ferry the kids back and forth that month, she knew in her heart that Jane was gone for good, although she would come back for a while. She would tell them that Alden had come along 10 years later after they had given up. And as if to make up for his tardiness, here was Alden still a lifelong bachelor. And in some ways Stella was grateful for that, because Alden was not terribly bright, and there are plenty of women willing to take advantage of a man with a slow brain and a good heart. Although she would not tell the children that last either. She would say, Lewis and Margaret Godlin begat Stella Godlin, who became Stella Flanders. Bill and Stella Flanders begat Jane and Alden Flanders, and Jane Flanders became Jane Wakefield. Richard and Jane Wakefield begat Lois Wakefield, who became Lois Perot. David and Lois Perot begat Lona and Hal. Those are your names, children. You are Godlin Flanders Wakefield Perot. Your blood is in the stones of this island, and I stay here because the mainland is too far to reach. Yes, I love. I have loved, anyway, or at least tried to love. But memory is so wide and so deep, and I cannot cross. Godlin Flanders Wakefield Perot. That was the coldest February since the National Weather Service began keeping records. And by the middle of the month, the ice covering the reach was safe. Snowmobiles buzzed and whined, and sometimes turned over when they climbed the ice heaves wrong. Children tried to skate, found the ice too bumpy to be any fun, and went back to Godlin's Pond on the far side of the hill. But not before little Justin McCracken, the minister's son, caught his skate in a fissure and broke his ankle. They took him over to the hospital on the mainland, where a doctor who owned a Corvette told him, Son, it's going to be as good as new. Freddie Dinsmore died very suddenly just 3 days after Justin McCracken broke his ankle. He caught the flu late in January, would not have the doctor, told everyone it was just a cold from going out to get the mail without my scarf, took to his bed, and died before anyone could take him across to the mainland and hook him up to all those machines they have waiting for guys like Freddie. His son, George, a tosspot of the first water, even at the advanced age, for tosspots anyway, of 68, found Freddie with a copy of the Bangor Daily News in one hand and his Remington unloaded near the other. Apparently he had been thinking of cleaning it just before he died. George Dinsmore went on a 3-week toot, said toot financed by someone who knew that George would have his old dad's insurance money coming. Hattie Stoddard went around telling anyone who would listen that old George Dinsmore was a sin and a disgrace, no better than a tramp for pay. There was a lot of flu around. The school closed for 2 weeks that February instead of the usual one because so many pupils were out sick. No snow breeds germs, Sarah Havelock said. Near the end of the month, just as people were beginning to look forward to the false comfort of March, Alden Flanders caught the flu himself. He walked around with it for nearly a week, and then took to his bed with a fever of 101. Like Freddie, he refused to have the doctor, and Stella stewed and fretted and worried. Alden was not as old as Freddie, but that May, he would turn 60. The snow came at last. 6 inches on Valentine's Day. Another 6 on the 20th, and a foot in a good old norther on the leap, February 29. The snow lay white and strange between the cove and the mainland, like a sheep's meadow, where there had been only gray and surging water at this time of year since time out of mind. Several people walked across to the mainland and back. No snowshoes were necessary this year, because the snow had frozen to a firm, glittery crust. They might take a knock of whiskey, too, Stella thought, but they would not take it at Dorrit's. Dorrit's had burned down in 1958. And she saw Bill all 4 times. Once he told her, "You ought to come soon, Stella. We'll go steppin'. What do you say?" She could say nothing. Her fist was crammed deep into her mouth. "Everything I ever wanted or needed was here," she would tell them. "We had the radio, and now we have the television, and that's all I want of the world beyond the reach. I had my garden year in and year out. And lobster Why, we always used to have a pot of lobster stew on the back of the stove. And we used to take it off and put it behind the door in the pantry when the minister came calling, so he wouldn't see we were eating poor man's soup. I have seen good weather and bad. And if there were times when I wondered what it might be like to actually be in the Sears store instead of ordering from the catalog, or to go into one of those Shaw's markets I see on TV instead of buying at the store here, or sending Alden across for something special, like a Christmas capon or an Easter ham, or if I ever wanted just once to stand on Congress Street in Portland and watch all the people in their cars and on the sidewalks, more people in a single look than there are on the whole island these days? If I ever wanted those things, then I wanted this more. I am not strange, I am not peculiar, or even very eccentric for a woman of my years. My mother sometimes used to say, "All the difference in the world is between work and want," and I believe that to my very soul. I believe it is better to plow deep than wide. This is my place, and I love it. One day in middle March, with the sky as white and lowering as a loss of memory, Stella Flanders sat in her kitchen for the last time, laced up her boots over her skinny calves for the last time, and wrapped her bright red woolen scarf, a Christmas present from Hattie three Christmases past, round her neck for the last time. She wore a suit of Alden's long underwear under her dress. The waist of the drawers came up to just below the limp vestiges of her breasts, the shirt almost down to her knees. Outside, the wind was picking up again, and the radio said there would be snow by afternoon. She put on her coat and her gloves. After a moment of debate, she put a pair of Alden's gloves on over her own. Alden had recovered from the flu, and this morning he and Harley Blood were over rehanging a storm door for Missy Boy, who had had a girl. Stella had seen it, and the unfortunate little mite looked just like her father. She stood at the window for a moment, looking out at the reach, and Bill was there, as she had suspected he might be, standing about halfway between the island and the head, standing on the reach just like Jesus out of the boat, beckoning to her, seeming to tell her by gesture that the time was late if she ever intended to step a foot on the mainland in this life. "If it's what you want, Bill," she fretted in the silence. "God knows I don't." But the wind spoke other words. She did want to. She wanted to have this adventure. It had been a painful winter for her. The arthritis which came and went irregularly was back with a vengeance, flaring the joints of her fingers and knees with red fire and blue ice. One of her eyes had gotten dim and blurry, and just the other day, Sarah had mentioned with some unease that the fire spot that had been there since Stella was 60 or so now seemed to be growing by leaps and bounds. Worst of all, the deep, griping pain in her stomach had returned, and 2 mornings before she had gotten up at 5 o'clock, worked her way along the exquisitely cold floor into the bathroom, and had spat a great wad of bright red blood into the toilet bowl. This morning there had been some more of it, foul-tasting stuff, coppery and shuddersome. The stomach pain had come and gone over the last 5 years, sometimes better, sometimes worse, and she had known almost from the beginning that it must be cancer. It had taken her mother and father and her mother's father as well. None of them had lived past 70, and so she supposed she had beat the tables those insurance fellows kept by a carpenter's yard. "You eat like a horse," Alden told her, grinning, not long after the pains had begun and she had first observed the blood in her morning stool. "Don't you know that old fogies like you are supposed to be peckish?" "Get on or I'll swat you," Stella had answered, raising a hand to her gray-haired son, who ducked, mock cringed, and cried, "Don't, Ma, take it back." Yes, she had eaten hearty, not because she wanted to, but because she believed, as many of her generation did, that if you fed the cancer, it would leave you alone. And perhaps it worked, at least for a while. The blood in her stools came and went, and there were long periods when it wasn't there at all. Alden got used to her taking second helpings and thirds when the pain was particularly bad, but she never gained a pound. Now it seemed the cancer